This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, it is that time of the week. It is time for the True Wealth Radio Show on this, of course, the greatest Tuesday you've had all week. And in studio with me today, as always,
Matt Dixon.
All right, Matt, we are off to the races.
Markets are moving. Everything's...
Yeah, well, like, and I don't know if you've noticed or not, but the markets are moving in ways that I'm not going to say I haven't seen in a while, but
it just feels kind of different, interesting
and telling. Like, yeah. There's a lot of this. I will say, like, the speculation in the market is kind of getting knocked around.
Can you, like, expand upon what that really means?
Yeah,
for the listener.
So think about it as there's a part of the market that we can kind of value intrinsically, or more intrinsically. We can sort of look at the data and the historicals and go, like, here's sort of fundamentally what we think a company is worth. But then there's things that are intangible and it's really hard to price.
Right. Like, for example, how much does AI benefit this company in the next 2 years?
Right. Yeah. That's just a stuff hard where you go, one. I don't even know how we're going to calculate that. I'm just like, well
you know
we
what also feels really weird right now is I feel like, On the federal government side, right, we are seeing some things kind of coming through the pipeline that really can change the financial landscape really quickly, right? Like 6 weeks ago, were we even thinking about Venezuelan oil? That wasn't on the radar, right?
Yeah, or sending aircraft carriers toward
to
the
Iran.
East.
Yeah, so we weren't factoring that. And then this silver thing has been...
Right,
like
now help
recent...
our listeners, a handful, if our listeners don't know, just give them a sense of what happened to silver in the last few days.
Well, yeah, see, I think that's the crazy thing. I have read countless articles to try and figure out what's really honestly happening with silver, and I'll tell you, I don't know. Because
tell you what happened in like an oversimplified way.
Maybe.
People stopped buying it, and a bunch of people wanted out fast.
Well, see, from everything I've read, there's been this huge like discrepancy in demand between the physical silver, and then you have like paper contracts on silver. And so, and then that's its own issue. And then I've also heard huge price gaps between countries, like what it's trading for in Japan or China versus what it's trading for in Europe versus what it's trading for in the United States. Mm-hmm. And, you know, typically in a normal market condition, it's like the same, right? If you denominate that silver in U.S. dollars, whether it's China or the United States, it's the same price, right? That hasn't been the case from everything I've been reading. And so paper contracts have been highly volatile, whereas the spot price has largely, you know, not experienced as big of a whipsaw in price movement. So I'm like, this is crazy times we're living in.
Yeah, and it's funny because I hear what people write, and then
that's the thing.
Here's
trust?
What I mean, though, is you can say a lot of things, but then I'm going to believe what my eyes see.
See, that's what I'm trying to say. I don't know what literature is right, what's wrong, and it seems like it's all contradicting itself.
Sure. And my larger point is it doesn't matter what somebody says is the cause if it's the market's still going to do what it's going to do. Like, one of my favorite things is when people say, well, you know, such and such company beat earnings, so their stock's going to go up.
No.
It doesn't always go up.
No, we've seen it go down so many times because everyone was pricing in an even bigger beat.
Well,
the
funny thing, though, is even that phraseology, what you just sort of implied is, well, we knew that there was something else and it wasn't that. And the truth is,
you don't always know.
What happens is, something shifts the supply and demand. And it doesn't have to be a lot of participants to move a market. In fact, sometimes when a stock is really thinly traded, or a position, we don't have to say stock, when it's really thinly traded, it moves a lot. Here's an example, okay? Let's just use a local example. I don't know where people are listening. A lot of folks are in our local area. We're in Douglas County, Oregon. It's a rural county, okay? if you get into the very upper end of real estate, where you're talking about $2-4 million homes and estates, like north of $1 million or so dollars.
Okay.
We don't sell very many of those in a year.
No.
Right? There's just not that many. So what that means is, if you have an asset like that, the value is only assuming somebody else is willing to buy it from you. Well, you're not in a very large market space any longer. Most people don't bother looking at places like that because they don't have the means, mm-hmm. which means it's thinly traded. There's only a handful of people that are even
and
capable.
And if it's thinly traded, the price can wildly Correct. Move higher or lower yeah, based you, on what someone's willing to pay.
If you want to sell it and there's nobody willing to buy it, yeah. then your only option is to lower the price until you find a willing buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's not a lot of participants, that's what happens. Silver was really interesting because there seems to be a lot of participants.
Yeah. Well, and it's crazy because I can remember a year ago or maybe 2 years ago, no one was hardly even talking about silver. It was only gold that they wanted to talk about. And
gold fell too, just not like silver.
Right, yeah.
I think, just to give you guys perspective, I think silver fell over 30% in a day.
So you want to know one of the articles I heard? True or not true, I don't know. But someone was saying that, and this is a thing, you can pull it up on the computer right now, but apparently the Chinese scientists have figured out a way to synthesize gold and silver in a lab and make
okay,
it.
Okay, now, so I've read up on right, some of this.
I
and
don't
say like turning lead into these things.
Yeah.
You know how they do it?
So they're no is the short answer.
Yeah. Particle and, accelerators.
Right.
And you know so, how much they make?
Very little.
Micrograms.
Yeah. Yes. But I'm saying all this to say, is it cost effective and will it just magically balloon? No.
I'm
and
shaking my head on the
correct.
Our radio listeners can't hear me shaking my head back and forth.
Yes.
No, it takes way more energy
exactly.
to produce than the value that's produced from
and
it.
That's what the article said. But it said what's crazy is in this day and age when information moves so quickly and AI and technology is exploding, there it can generate real fear that causes people to have an emotional response and trade based on it, whether it's true or not. And they're like, we actually believe that some of the drawdown in the price, was it yesterday or today, was accredited to this article coming out, even though it's not going to change the actual, you know, supply side of gold and silver, but just news could move the price maybe 2-3%. Potentially. That's wild to think about that
Very
a spoof
much.
Article.
Well,
that,
yeah,
I mean,
that's
it's not even really a spoof
thing.
Article. It's just like, yeah,
well,
they can do it, like you said, but it's just micro ounces or grams or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, it's
tiny. Irrelevant. It's irrelevant.
It's at a molecular scale.
Exactly. It's irrelevant to the metal, but it was relevant to the market.
So here's what's interesting. And like everybody out there listening, if you're not aware of this, this is a thing. We've talked about it on this program a little bit over the years. We've talked about some of the things like algorithmic trading. We've
mm-hmm.
talked about high-frequency trading. Well, there is also sentiment trading.
Yes.
And some of the things that were interesting, there were some hedge funds and other organizations that literally created computer programs that tracked what was being discussed on things like Reddit boards
yep.
and Twitter. Where this first started to really show up on my radar was when you had folks that were parsing they were using artificial intelligence to read the minutes of the Federal Reserve as soon as they were published, right after Fed announcements. And so it would go in and just look for certain keywords and statements and the frequency that they appeared,
mm-hmm.
and then it would make trade orders within fractions of a second of that
just
news
almost
dropping.
Instantaneous.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so now what we're seeing is what are trending topics, and then it's correlating that with market behaviors and price trends.
Interesting.
So you have these algorithms that aren't using, they're using quantitative analysis, but they're using quantitative analysis of sentiment, which is sort of mind-blowing to me that you can take and crowdsource opinion and then try to make trade decisions on it.
That is pretty wild. So I'm going to botch this and fumble this. So
Fun.
Help me. Can you help me through this? This is kind of going back to the same idea, though, around like the gold and the silver stuff. But I was reading something that was talking about how there's a theory going around And I've heard it now from multiple different angles that JP Morgan Chase, right, might have been way outside the money on some options stuff that they put out on the market regarding the price of silver, the paper contracts, going back to the paper contracts, and that they were out of the money so long that they had to make people whole on those, right? And so they were trying to acquire silver, and the price kind of kept going up, and there was a ton of short interest in silver by JP Morgan, big banking company, right? And that some of that big 30-something percent drawdown we saw in silver a couple days ago was the bank system potentially trying to get involved and push the price of silver lower in order to be not so far out of the money. Have you heard this theory? I'm curious.
I have, mostly from you.
Okay.
I have heard this idea that JP Morgan was hedging silver and that they were out of position on their hedging and it was the market was going against them.
Yeah.
It's all rumors.
You know what I do know? I know our listeners tend to be in this a lot. Mm-hmm. I'd be curious to see if we have any listeners that are tuned in and have an opinion on what's going on in these markets and texting that opinion into the work number. Can they do that?
Yep, give them the number.
All right, so the phone number, 541-375-0898. If you have an opinion on what's going on with silver, I'd love to hear it.
Right, because at this point, that what I have is rumors and opinions, and I can talk about the mechanical things a little bit. We could talk about the concept of market making, supply and demand pressures. We could data fit theories, but I don't know.
Yeah, that's crazy.
To me, it's wild when you see a market that's broadly followed like silver or gold, right? These are international markets, and then you see a 30% price adjustment. That actually tells me something. There's something more concerning that either the markets are capable of really getting it wrong or the markets are capable of really being manipulated. Both of those things are concerning.
Are terrifying, yes.
Yeah.
I agree with you. Should we talk about, like, maybe when we get back from the break, some other times in history where you've seen, like, really big volatile swings like that and what it's kind of meant to the investor?
So, yeah, let's unpack some of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the good news is silver's pretty isolated in a unique market. We could talk more about that, but yeah, let's grab a break. When we come back, we'll unpack that for investors and more. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Okay, game, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where, reminder, if you were just getting caught up with us, grab the podcast. It's available at littlejohnfs.com. A lot of people, by the way, Matt, they're like, hey, what do we do with the podcast? And it's interesting to me because I guess I take it for granted. It's not that hard if you've never done a podcast. First of all, you don't have to get a podcast anything. You can go to our website, and we literally put the shows on the website, so you can just listen to it right there. But they're also available through podcast vendors. I don't know what we call them, suppliers. So Apple, for example, they've got their own version of podcasts, and you can go and search for Little John Financial and True Wealth Show, and it will find it, and then you can see all these past episodes, and so that's where you can subscribe, and it will notify you, and then you can get these, and you can listen to them if you never figured out the podcast thing before. And if you're doing the podcast thing, you're like, yeah, thanks for telling me what I already know. So you're welcome. Okay, Matt.
Yeah.
You kind of asked a loaded question. Let me see if I can get this right.
Okay.
At the break, you were saying, have I seen other periods of time where the markets had like extreme volatility?
Yeah, and maybe that's not even the best way to ask it. So I think why it feels weird maybe right now is, you know, like typically when stocks or something are doing really well, then you might see silver, gold kind of flat or lagging. We're seeing right now, and over the last maybe 6 months or whatever, a correlation where silver and gold are going way higher and stocks are going way higher, and it's like everything is pushing up instead of like things that are normally inversely correlated now seem to be kind of correlated in a weird way. The correlations feel weird, I guess, mm-hmm. is what I'm trying to say. And I'm like, how do you digest that? And have you seen that before where things that are not normally correlated start to kind of run together?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
It's going the other way.
Okay. So, yeah, normally, like, if something's going down, everything's going down in a real bad situation.
Yeah,
sure.
So this is an opportunity to remind folks the difference between idiosyncratic risk and systemic risk. Now, super nerdy terms. Let me break it down into real layman's terms for you so that nobody tries to fly by you. Idiosyncratic risk is the same as saying one-off risk. It's a risk that's unique to a company, right? CEO mm-hmm. gets caught for embezzling. Okay, that's not a problem for every company out there. That's a problem for that company.
Yep.
So the way that you manage idiosyncratic or one-off risk is diversification, right? You don't put all your eggs in one basket, because if something goes wrong with that single egg, it's like, oh, I got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've also talked a little bit about you don't want to get all the same types of eggs and put them in one basket and think you're really diversified, because you're very concentrated in a specific area. What happens if you see a regulatory change? A real life example is tariffs. When you go, oh, yeah. Well, we're going to put specific tariffs on specific products. Okay. That becomes not a system-wide problem, but a sector-wide problem. And so if you have a lot of things that are going to be similarly affected by that type of decision, it's not a company risk, but it's that portion of the market.
Mm-hmm.
Now, systemic risk is a lot like it sounds. It's the whole system. It gets everything.
Yeah.
That is something like, oh, we changed tax policy. Well, that's going to get everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
That is when you have some kind of event that is broad sweeping and affects the market at large.
Yeah, like if they came out with a policy that said we're going to tax everyone 20% extra mm-hmm. on the federal level.
Yeah.
Like what would the markets do?
Well, you know, I'll say this and I realize that it's okay. COVID was one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not making a political statement. Hopefully that's not something that like the algos flag and go like, you can't talk about it, period. It's like, no, that was a systemic risk. It was broad sweeping and affected virtually everything. So that kind of scenario is something that you can't diversify for.
Correct.
So you asked me the question about sort of what happens when you see things start to become correlated.
Yeah.
That's another way of saying diversification stops working. Like,
yeah.
Oh, things are highly correlated. Ah, diversification's not working. That's what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so, yeah. But sometimes that's not what's going on. Let's not confuse correlation with causation.
Ooh, yeah. Because
okay.
What's causing something
what's
to act?
What's causing something may not actually be what it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I try to think of like a really silly example, which is like, you know, having cake causes people to have birthdays. No, that's just, it comes together, but it's like the cake is actually has nothing to do with whether or not you're going to have a birthday. We just tend to have birthday cake, right?
Mm-hmm.
So silly example, very extreme, but hopefully it makes sense to everybody. The idea is, I think if we're talking probably about silver, because we've been talking about this,
mm-hmm.
why does it seem like it's tracking a lot like the stock market right now? Stock market was going up, silver was going up.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Normally it's kind of its own market. It could be coincidental that it just happens to be that the stock market's been going up because of inflationary pressure, and silver is also something that helps to fight inflationary pressure, but it also benefits from being an industrial metal that's got high use in AI, which happens to be the largest driving factor in the markets right now.
Right.
So those things all kind of came together at the same time, and you go, well, is it correlated, or is it just that the circumstances makes it look correlated right
mm-hmm.
now?
So it might be less about people being scared that the dollar is devaluing and they need to go buy an alternative asset. And just it could be as simple as, no, the market really is pricing in that there's going to be that much demand for it in an industrial use.
Right. And here's why this case seems more true to me.
Oh, that's where I was picking at this, yeah. David. I was trying
why
to
did,
get,
why
yeah.
does this seem more true that it may simply be that there's an excess demand beyond what we would typically see for silver, and it's not because of a currency collapse. The reason that it appears that way is look at cryptocurrency.
Yeah, the crypto thing is wild because it's been getting hammered.
Yes, we have seen Bitcoin, Ethereum, a lot of the other crypto areas of the marketplace just way, way beat up, off, 30 to 50% over the last 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, really beat down. What was the use case for crypto? What's everybody said?
Well, we don't trust the currency. So we're going to convert it to crypto.
Interesting. Well, yeah, we're not printing more. There's a finite supply. It's like digital gold.
Yep.
Right? It's an inflation hedge. It's going to be an area to store value.
Yeah.
Well, if that's the case, why has silver and gold gone up in response to inflation while we've seen cryptocurrencies go down?
I think you're asking the right questions. And I don't think we can answer those on air, but I think we can throw the question out there and let it fester in your mind.
Well, this is the stuff Matt and I are giving it, we're chuckling about this because this is stuff that we talk about in our investment committee.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, I'm going to give a little backdrop for everybody listening. Why does it seem pseudo-secretive about this? Right? It's not pseudo-secretive. We don't have a secret sauce that we're not willing to share. On air, we have to be careful because we're actual financial advisors. We have clients. We give them advice.
We have real jobs?
Yes.
Wow. I think some of the listeners are shocked. They're like, I thought you were just the radio guys. No. No, we're not.
It's fun because I'm like, I can't believe I get to do this for work, right? Because financial advice is really fun for me. Like, I love our clients, and it's the best. So I feel really lucky. So sometimes when it's like, is that a job? I'm like, I guess, but it doesn't feel like work. I love doing it. Or maybe what we should say is more work should feel like that so you don't resent work.
There you go.
But what happens? Like, I tell you this all the time, right, Matt? What can we not give live on air?
We can't give you personalized financial advice, unfortunately, because guess what? Your circumstances are probably a little different than someone else's.
Yeah. And the idea is that there's no way to give personalized financial advice. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, well, I hear, such and such talking head who says, go do this. Here's my favorite one, just for context, really quick. I'm not picking. I'm just pointing this out. Yeah, you should go buy aggressive growth, and income, and
a mutual
international
fund.
Mutual funds.
Yeah.
To which I say, congratulations, that was not advice. Those are not real. Those are not very measurable categories, right? Growth and aggressive growth. Okay. Subjective as to what that means.
Mm-hmm.
International, less subjective, but it's still pretty broad based. Income, also pretty subjective. There are some definitional things, but do you have any idea what to buy with that advice?
Nope. It just sounds like a bunch of.
Correct. It's a little bit like saying buy low and sell high. Mm-hmm. I can't get in trouble for telling you that. Because that's true. If you buy low and sell high, you'll make money. And so, great. That's great advice. Now, if I tell you how to do it, that's different.
Yeah.
Right? I could tell you spend less than you make. That's pretty sound advice. I'm not going to get in trouble for that. Like, that's kind of universal for everybody. And I can tell you when you're a knucklehead. But
that's my favorite. You want to? Should we go down that rabbit hole next?
We did that last week.
Oh, darn.
Yeah, you guys go check that podcast out if you want to hear me go on a rant. But the idea, though, is we reference the investment committee because we really do this stuff, but we don't talk about it in a lot of specifics because your mileage may vary, so we don't want it to be construed as advice.
Mm-hmm.
But we do need to talk more about this because this question of crypto versus the metals market and how they're going in opposite directions, what does that mean? And here, Matt, I'll plant a seed. Let's go to break. When we come back, I'm also going to wrap up the question about oil.
Ooh.
Right? Oil yeah. and crypto, another weird one.
Yeah.
All
that's
right.
That's been in the headlines.
Let's talk about that when we come back. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Welcome back to the True Wealth Show. Okay, Matt, we got to oil you up.
Wow, the puns. The puns are rich. They're rich.
What could possibly go wrong with that statement on YouTube, right? Now, we were talking about strange correlation in the marketplace right now, and a couple of the things that are legitimately interesting. So one, we have how we have seen this divergence between cryptocurrency and precious metals.
Yep.
That's not really typical, but we've also seemed to see recent correlation between oil prices and crypto.
Yeah.
Talk to me about this, Matt. Like, what are we seeing?
So basically, there's this underlying, you know, kind of correlation there where if oil, right, is getting more expensive, then, you know, it's spiking in price. In the back of your mind, you have to be thinking, could inflation be coming back, right? Because if inflation's returning, that leads to things like higher interest rate expectations, which is tighter money,
stronger
dollar.
We're going to come back to that question because I'm going to ask you, is it?
Well, if you walk it down the line, right, if you have a tighter money supply and a stronger dollar, that's bad for crypto. Right?
True.
Yeah. I mean, crypto thrives when money's cheap and when it's flowing. So if oil's up and there's inflationary fears of like tighter policy or whatever, crypto could be on its way down.
Well, here's why I think it's interesting. Let's talk about another one of the pull me. Like there's push me parts of economic policy and there's pull me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's fascinating to me to look at what we're seeing is suppliers getting disrupted. Right? First, Venezuela gets disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
Now Iran is being disrupted. So what we see is oil supply going offline. That
and
to me
OPEC
suggests,
played a big role in that.
Right. And so what that suggests to me is that this is not as simple as saying, this is inflationary, because inflationary would also have something to do with the demand side of the equation, right? The dollars in circulation are part of demand. This is supply side.
Yeah. So the supply is being affected. Oil is being driven higher, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when that happens and oil goes higher, what's that doing? It's draining cash from the consumer.
Well, it does increase in what we would call staple, right? So that would be certainly taxing in terms of discretionary income.
I think it's a liquidity thing, right?
But is that inflationary or deflationary? I'm just playing it devil's advocate and having fun with you here.
Yeah.
Because consider.
I mean, I guess if it happened for too long,
if you have to spend on fuel,
mm-hmm.
then you can't spend elsewhere.
Right.
Then there's actually fewer dollars in circulation, which would be deflationary in certain sectors, like discretionary sectors.
So I guess maybe it depends on how long the inflation lasts for.
Aha.
That's the magic ticket.
Right. And well, what's the cause? Because supply side causes, to me, feel a little different than demand side causes. Like demand side is money supply.
Mm.
Okay. When you lower interest rates, what you're doing is you're stimulating demand by putting more dollars in people's pockets. But if you're not changing interest rates, but you reduce supply, right? Imagine if we condemned 10% of all the houses in the United States.
Okay.
They were just unavailable to live in any longer. Houses would get more expensive,
mm-hmm.
because you just change the supply side of the curve. By the way, guys, I don't mean to gloss over this, but supply and demand, it's kind of that first entry level economics where the way that you determine the price of something is you say, well, how much is there in existence and how many people want to buy it? And then they kind of figure out the balance point between those two. And it looks like an X, right? One chart is one is a line going one direction, the other is another. It looks like an X. One of those curves or one of those lines is the supply line. The other is the demand side. And if you change where that demand or supply is, it changes the price point. That's the most basic part of economics. By the way, if this is something where you're like, you know what, will you just make a video for me about this? We could probably do that. I would say text us. And if that would be valuable, we'll produce it and throw it on YouTube as a basic, just so that everybody can get that understanding dialed. It's fundamental to the way price is established in period. Like, it is like the basic thing that everybody should know. You don't have to be an economics expert, but you need to understand supply and demand if this conversation is going to be relevant for you.
Okay.
Hey.
Like,
so 541-375-0898. Send us a text and say, yep, make the supply demand video. Now that we have that out of the way, Matt.
Okay.
So is oil inflationary or deflationary?
I think it's just a matter of how long do you see the prices elevated for?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How long before the consumer has to adapt? Can they absorb it for a little while or not?
Mm-hmm.
Because honestly, fuel prices got a lot lower. You know, we're seeing that low $3 a gallon in Oregon, and there's other places in the country where it's like low $2.
I think the problem there is it takes it a while for the gas prices at the pump to really reflect the price of oil. And it's been a recent thing. Oil was down to like $50-something dollars a barrel, and then it shot up into the high 60s. And it did it in a matter of just like a few days, it felt like. And so, you know, by the time that oil gets to the refinery, gets refined, turns into gasoline, gets on a truck, gets put in the ground, you finally pump it into your vehicle, it's like, well, there's a little bit
of
a delay.
Lag, yeah. There's some lag.
So I do think that we're going to start to see prices at the pump start to jump higher and stay higher.
They're going up. You can see it.
And I think it's going to stay up until we get this thing with Iran figured out.
Okay. Yeah, that's a whole nother conversation, which I'll admit I haven't read up enough on it.
Everyone thinks that gas is going to go way down because we have this magic supply of Venezuelan oil. And it's like, you do realize that for us to like turn a profit on that oil, selling it as gasoline, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of refinement that maybe doesn't pencil right now.
No, because like I think the break-even point on that sour, nasty crude coming from Venezuela is in the $80 a barrel range. And it's like, we're not there. We're in the high 60s last I checked. So we're a long ways away from needing to turn that into fuel.
I don't know the numbers on it. I've never heard it called sour, nasty crude before. That makes me laugh.
Dude, I'm serious. Google it. Yeah, it's
sour, nasty crude.
Nasty.
I mean, I've heard of light, sweet crude, and then I've just heard of crude. But I've never heard it sour crude. It sounds like, don't put that on your hot dog. Right?
No, but you can put it on your roof. Crude. It's good roofing tar.
So, okay. Well, and what was the article today? We're looking at a million new houses we're trying to build, something like that?
Yeah, the big-time home builders pitched it to the White House. Hey, we want to build a million homes that are affordable. You want to wave your magic wand and make that happen? So we'll see if they get a response.
What was it? Was it Ronald Reagan that used to say that there's a saying about subsidizing things? And it's basically if it moves, tax it. If it stops moving, subsidize it. You know, and it's like, well, that's housing, but that's kind of housing in Oregon too. I always think it's an oxymoron to say affordable housing in Oregon.
Because, you know what's really weird to think about?
The permitting alone is like, well, that's not going to be affordable by the time you pay to get started. And so the only way that it becomes affordable is if we subsidize it, which is not a natural market force.
Yeah, part of the underlying push was for Trump to come in and like have the government start buying mortgage-backed securities. That was literally part of the article, and I'm like,
interesting. So first the Federal Reserve can do it, and then the government can as well.
Yeah.
Great.
I'm like, wait a minute. Yeah.
Jeez, we've never seen that playbook before.
I know. I'm like, wait a minute. I need to open up a history book.
Yes. That if you guys are unaware, we're kind of making some sort of, you know, snarky references to mortgage-backed securities are what really initiated a lot of the collapse of 2008.
Yeah.
And it was this idea that mortgage-backed securities that were not well underwritten loans were packaged together and then reinsured and sold as if they were quality investments when in fact they were very low quality. And so the people that bought them were sort of informed that they were healthier than they were. And then when things went wrong, it ended up being sort of a house of cards built upside down. Mm-hmm. So if you had any part of it get weak, the whole thing collapsed. And then we had this massive financial crisis in 2008, that, you know, between 2007 and 2008 that played out. But it was mortgage-backed securities that precipitated a lot of that meltdown.
Yeah.
So now we're saying, well, you know what we ought to try? It's only been 18 years. Nobody's going to remember that. So why don't we try it again?
Yeah.
And I hope that these are just rumors and that we're not serious about it. Because
oh, it was a serious proposal. Yeah. And what was crazy is the three major like U.S. home builders that have the scale and ability to pull a feat like that off were up like 6% to start the morning. And then I think they faded to like up 3% at the end of the day.
And I'm like, just going to go on record. This is another one of those that makes me less popular when I say it, but you're not going to make housing affordable through sleight of hand and trickery, right? There's no economic trickery that you can pull off where you say, you know what we're going to do? We're going to not fix the supply side of the equation. What we're going to try to do is pump money into, like, so we'll subsidize home buyers. We won't fix the price of the home. We'll just, if you're a first-time home buyer or if you meet certain criteria, we'll just subsidize you. And again, I go, subsidizing doesn't fix something that's broken. It actually feeds it and breaks it more.
Here's what's
right?
crazy.
There's no natural market correction when you subsidize something that doesn't work.
And even if they did build a million homes over 50 states, that's 20,000 homes per state. Like, that's not that much, really. Well, as crazy as it sounds, like, it's really not even that many homes.
It's not that it's that many homes, but if we did the math different, average household of four people, then it's 4 million people.
Yeah.
If the population of 330 million, it's a little over 1% of the population.
Yeah.
It's not nothing, for
no.
sure.
No.
Right? I would say it would move the needle. That's a lot of homes.
Yeah. How would, I mean, I think the only way that they could drive the price down, like you said, right, if you don't drive the price down, then it's just a stress on the middle class, right?
You mean like even more stress?
Yeah,
on middle
even
class?
More stress. I'm like, how do you really get the price down? There would have to be some stepping in, I think, from the federal government of like, I don't know if they could even override the states on this, but deregulating some of the way that the building codes are, you know, slowing stuff down and the permitting fees
so
too.
I have some basic thoughts on this. They're probably way too simple. I'm happy to share them, but we got to take a break.
All right.
All right, let's do that. When we come back, I don't know, we could brainstorm a little bit about what might be viable solutions to lower housing costs.
Okay, and who is the big winner financially if this were to go through?
All right, stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang. Welcome back to the Home Stretch of the True Wealth Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio, of course, with
Matt Dixon.
And, boy, we're having a day of it.
Sure.
We kind of left. We've talked about strange conditions in the markets, correlation, causation, diversification, all the Asians, right? And here we are with our last segment, and I'm trying to remember, we had a great question, Matt, but what was it?
It got so hot in here that my brain melted, and it's just worthless now.
We were going to talk about how are we going to lower the cost of housing potentially, right? We were talking about
shanties.
Well, you know, and I rant a little bit about this behind the scenes that when you subsidize things, you tend to break parts of the economy.
Yeah.
Because what you're doing is you're just saying, well, we're not going to let natural forces do this, where we're going to have supply and demand get balanced. We're going to artificially move the curve. And it may feel good for a little while, but it all ultimately the system will force correct it. This is why you can't raise minimum wage and just say, well, we're going to make every job a living wage job. No, you won't. What you'll do is some people will be overcompensated for a little while, and then those jobs will disappear, or they'll get roboticized or automated, or everything else will get more expensive too, to the point that the new minimum wage has the same buying power as the old minimum wage. It's just everything had to adjust.
Yeah, that one.
It just breaks for a little while. Like, people thought they had money when there was government checks that went out during the
COVID,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And
everyone
it felt
was
pretty
just,
good for a little while. Great, let's all go spend it. And then everybody later goes, well, there's all this inflation. It's crazy. You go, well, of course there was inflation. We printed money and gave it away.
So do you think that the million homes, if they were cheap enough, would kind of be the same way?
Well, no. I think that the million homes, the only way that they're cheap is if we subsidize them.
That's the only way you see it happening.
Well, in
yeah.
most areas.
I mean,
right?
Yeah.
There are some areas where building code is really, you can still build pretty affordably by
right.
comparison.
Yeah.
And you see that in different areas of the country where housing is a lot more affordable.
Like right.
A lot more affordable.
It's true. It's true.
You know, it's a third of the cost of what it is in Oregon in certain areas of the country.
Yeah. I think Texas is one of those states, if I remember right, where the building restrictions are way looser like than they are in Oregon,
yeah.
for
like,
example.
They don't have the same land use restrictions. And
correct.
The building codes and
yeah.
whatnot are easier. So I will tell you that the solve, I probably have more opinions about the solves locally in Oregon than I do
like on a national scale.
Nationally, but
yeah.
I think principally these largely work. We have some structural issues in Oregon. We have urban growth boundaries, we have land use requirements, and because of that, you have only so many people paying into a tax base because we've kind of structured the tax base at a certain finite amount.
Mm.
And when you do that, then you kind of get your budget for what you get. And the tax on the system is things like infrastructure. Okay, we can only produce so much water and we can only process so much sewage until you have to have another treatment facility.
Yeah.
But we have only so much money that we're capable of generating through taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And that money is also being competed with for public services and for wages and for the rising cost of benefits and all those other things. And so you see the increase in the overhead cost of running government exceed the tax base and how it's increasing.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, what do you get? You get destruction of the availability of services.
And doesn't that just make you want to buy an off-grid cabin where it's like I've got all my own food and I don't have hookups to the city water and sewer? Like, I don't have to deal with all of this.
Except for the part where in our state, there's all of these land use restrictions that would say you can't necessarily just do that.
Yeah. Oregon's not friendly for that.
Yeah. And many places aren't.
Okay. So let's start a commune and move to a more friendly state. Are you in?
I'm going to need more details.
I thought I had him sold. I really did. I've got some Kool-Aid over here for you.
I'm out. Oh, you know, this is the issue that we run into that I wish we could get more people to think through. It's a little preachy here, but this isn't a partisan thing. About the time somebody shows up and says, I'm going to walk into government and change everything, I'm going to fix it. And then they show up and they can't fix it. And then later on, somebody else comes in and says, now it's my turn to say I can fix it. And then they can't fix it. Why is that? We start looking at the system at large and realize there's only so many levers that our elected officials can pull, right? Like
yeah.
they don't have the authority over everything. And, you know, we don't elect czars and kings, despite what people would protest or otherwise claim. That's not how it works. And so there are structural things that prevent us from going bananas. But there are also structural things that are really hard to fix because of it.
Yeah.
And so that's the issue that we run into. And so I am a cynic when I say, yeah, affordable housing. Affordable in and of itself is a subjective term. Affordable to whom?
Yeah. Yeah, because for someone, $125,000 for a house still isn't affordable.
Yep. And so that's, you know, there are lots of issues here. I think there are some things that most sane, grounded folks in this country can agree to. One of them is none of us likes to see waste. None of us likes to see a government that is not fully truthful, mm-hmm. right? A government that uses information as a tool of manipulation rather than a tool of information is a problem.
Yeah.
I don't want to be duped by my government. It's supposed to work for me. It's not supposed to manipulate me. And I don't think I'm saying something that's terribly unique, and I don't think I'm saying something that's terribly partisan.
Yeah.
Right? I think we would all like to have a government that functions a little bit better, and we'd all like to, if we're going to pay the taxes, we'd like to get what we pay for.
So say someone's listening to the show right now, and they're like, you know, what I want to do is get to meet you, Dave. You're my type of guy. I'm really enjoying this conversation that you guys are having. And they want you to look at their finances and kind of give it a once over. How do they get a hold of the firm?
Okay. We have a phone number, and we have a website, and we have all the different ways that you can do this.
Can they even text our phone number?
They can.
Oh, my gosh.
We have all of these technological ways to reach us. All right, so I'm going to lay it out there. Phone number first. The area code's 541, pretty straightforward, 375-0898. Okay? That one, call, text, whatever. Remind folks, we do the free consult for a reason. You hear somebody on the radio, that doesn't mean that they're actually cool. Like, you walk in and go, like, this is not what I expected.
Mm.
That could happen. And so we do not charge for an initial consult to just kind of figure out if it would be a good fit or if we can actually help you or not. That's very intentional. We don't want any pressure on this stuff. It's got to be the right fit. But that's what you could do. You could just schedule some time. So you can call us. We have an email. It's info@littlejohnfs.com. Why is there an FS? Because somebody else already had Little John, those turkeys, and I couldn't get it.
So dang.
Littlejohnfs.com. But yeah, that's it. We're on all the socials and all the other things. There's lots of ways to find us. You can Google us. We're out there.
Yeah.
And you know, I remind folks, if you don't have somebody, we're happy to talk to you. We're licensed in virtually every state in the U.S., so we have clients even abroad. So it's not like we can't work with you. It's just a matter of it's a good fit.
Perfect. I love
there
it.
You go. All right. So, Matt, in the last 15 seconds, what would you like to tell our listeners?
I would tell them that they need to go enjoy the rest of their Tuesday by having some tacos, and then once they're fueled up, give us a call.
All right, you heard it here. Well, we're out of time for now, so until next time, thanks for tuning in. You can listen to The True Wealth.